Shaping Communities, the Work of Professional Planners. The Maine Association of Planners is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. As you might imagine, over that past half century, the work they do has changed a great deal. Today, professional planners must take into account all kinds of factors when they're working on a project. Environmental concerns, high-speed internet, energy, economic impact, finance, you name it. Usually planners stay out of the spotlight, but the work they do has long-term impacts on the communities they serve. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This hour, we'll learn more about planning and specifically planners in our region. The big question, how do you create and sustain the places that make Maine special? Do you have a story about planning in your community? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. My guests today do the kind of work that impacts everyone, but is often overlooked by people as they go about their everyday lives. Municipal planners help cities and towns address zoning questions, traffic issues, broadband access, and more. They work with elected officials, environmentalists, and businesses, and more. Today, we'll learn about the work of these planners. Joining me in the studio, Sarah Marchant. Did I pronounce that right?
Marchant.
Marchant. She is president of the Northern New England chapter of the American Planning Association and director of community development for the city of Nashua, New Hampshire. Ben Smith is here. He's the founder of North Star Planning. And Mark Eierman is a semi-retired planner who now runs the consulting firm Plan Me. He is the former president of Planning Decisions Incorporated. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been part of a planning process in your community? Do you have questions about how it works? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm going to start with you, Mark. I understand that the Maine Association of Planners is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And I'm wondering if we can step back in history. How did the whole idea of planning or planners come about? And how has it evolved in that time?
How far do you want to step back?
We have time.
Obviously, people often forget that many of the earliest colonial cities, towns, were planned communities. Philadelphia was a planned community. Savannah, Georgia was a planned community. So the idea that somebody said, we want to think about how we want our community, our built environment to be, goes back centuries, and in the United States goes back to the 16 or 1700s. In Maine, what you started to see in 1950s, 1960s, is the beginning of communities, particularly in the southern part of the state or the cities like Bangor, to begin to be concerned about how development, growth, or even decline was occurring. And so planning became part of the municipal lexicon and has really grown over the last 50 years.
Sure. I'm thinking about, and we'll talk more about this later in the program, but some of the biggest issues facing planners today, high-speed broadband, internet, that is not something that was there all along.
That's correct. And the issues continue to evolve as people think about things. I mean, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when I started working in the state of Maine, design, how things looked, was not a really big issue, big concern. Now it's become a major concern in many communities when you have new development.
Sarah, you're the current president of the Northern New England organization, and you have a conference coming up. That's why you're in Maine, is because the conference is this week. I want to read to you from the conference blurb here and ask you to explain that. You say, The definition, the conference name this year is Defining Resiliency for Northern New England. And you write, from the national to state to local levels, we have found that with the economic, political, and environmental change we are experiencing, the planning approaches we use are in danger of becoming effective or irrelevant. Explain that. What kinds of approaches are we having to rethink today?
I think there's several aspects to what we do that we really start to rethink. How we communicate with the public and how they communicate back with us is really important. A big part of being a planner and the role of a planner is a facilitator of the conversation of the community, of that future planning and building, how we see our communities in the future and how we're preserving our past. And how we get that messaging across or how we have those engagement processes has entirely changed in the past 5 or 10 years. The ways we communicate or absorb information have multiplied. And so it's a lot harder for planners to best understand what their communities want and to get that feedback. And so it's a challenge to all of us as planners to really reach out to our communities to get that engagement. We're not just asking people to come to a public meeting. We know that doesn't work. And so how do we get to people? How do we get their ideas? Everybody's busy. Everybody has 100 things to do every day. And how are we making sure we're interacting with people appropriately? On the economic side, we're seeing major shifts in all of our economies. And broadband's a big piece of that, certainly allowing businesses to thrive in all areas of our communities. Another part is changing of the climate. And we have huge flooding problems, flood resiliency issues, and making sure that we are looking to the future to preserve those resources and plan to be able to be more resilient in the face of these increasing number of natural disasters, while at the same time encouraging the growth in our economies in a way that's very sustainable.
Ben, how does someone become a professional planner?
I think there's a number of ways. Speaking for myself, it was a process of really being interested in some of what I felt were the bigger issues taking place in Maine back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Large blocks of land in northern Maine were changing hands. There were dams being removed around the state. And the way I got involved in those things, because I wasn't a scientist, I wasn't a forester, I wasn't involved in real estate, was to think about how do you get involved at a policy level. And I attended the Muskie School of Public Service at USM, and they had a planning program that allowed, it was basically a pipeline for new planners to enter the labor market for planners in Maine.
Do you find that many people had another career first and went back to school to get more specific knowledge about becoming a planner?
Yeah, I think that's true with many folks. I speaking for myself, I know people who were journalists before becoming planners. I know people who were engineers who were became planners later. So I think that planning is one of those jobs. And I think the role of planners is to tie a lot of these threads together and connect the dots between different silos, whether it's in a town environment or a county or state environment, but make sure a lot of these functions are being pulled together and connected over time as well.
I want to ask each of you, and I'll start with you again, Mark, to tell me about some of the projects that you've worked on as a planner that you're proud of, that maybe presented a challenge, but in the end turned out pretty great.
Okay. Let me just follow up for a minute
sure.
on what Ben said. I mean, I think the real task of planners, and, you know, if you think about people who plan for their retirement or businesses that plan, in terms of municipal planning, it really is the same issue, and that is thinking about what you want the community to be in the future. What are the issues? What directions? And, you know, one project that's gone on in the state that I think is really innovative is the state, in conjunction with a number of municipalities in the state and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has created a new way to regulate what are called vernal pools. Vernal pools are a special kind of wetland in which a number of small endangered species live in. Both the state and the Army Corps have regulated how development can occur, but there was a recognition that that regulation wasn't accomplishing what it was intended to do. It was requiring vernal pools in developed areas to be left that had really very little ecological value, and pools that were high value not to be very well protected. And so the state, the Army Corps, have created a program that allows low-value vernal pools in places where communities want growth and development to not have to meet the current rules in return for providing a lot more protection, permanent protection through land purchase or easements for high-value vernal pools in other areas. That's something that was a three-year issue to get all of the federal and state people to say, yes, that makes sense. Communities want to have development here, but we're impeding that. We're not protecting resources. So that's the sort of things I think are the real challenges.
All right, Sarah, what about you? I understand you were involved in a chicken debate.
Yes, actually, it's still ongoing. we're almost there, I think. But so the one of the number one phone calls that we get at the front office is, can I have chickens? And I work in a normal New England-sized city. It's about 90,000 people. And so it has very suburban edges, but a pretty urban core, much like Portland. And the rule is no. The answer has been no. And that was unacceptable. We have a large immigrant population as well. We have a lot of people who are really showing interest in this. And so we've been working with some of the aldermen and our legal team to find a way to safely, sustainably, and respectfully allow people to have chickens within the community. A small number, no roosters, having enough space and light and storage. And so we're almost there, I think. But it has been quite a long discussion, and it has been awesome to see. It's one of the best initiatives I work on recently, where the people who show up are just everyday people who are really in favor of this. Whereas a lot of times we have rooms filled that are very divided. The vast majority of people who are showing up at discussions and public hearings are people who really want to see this happen. And so that's been great.
You're talking about how long it takes to happen. You said 3 years in the vernal pool project. I'm thinking that maybe one of the things a planner needs to have is patience.
Yes, absolutely.
And somebody who can smile and say, it's been really fun to have years of meetings on the same subject. I want to bring you into this, Ben. What are some projects? You're working on some pretty big ones right now, aren't you?
Yeah, there are several projects I'm working on. I think one of the most interesting ones in rural Maine is being on a team doing some of the planning work for the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. That is a federal-level project, and it's certainly a big regional impact as well. I think bringing it down to a town level, I've worked for a long time in the town of Windham, and like a number of other towns in Maine, they have a downtown that kind of grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it's not a traditional downtown with brick buildings right up on a sidewalk. It's more auto oriented. And I think the future of places like that is going to involve a lot of infill and retrofitting. And that's really what we've worked on for the 21st century downtown plan on Windham. And that's a big area of interest in the state of Maine, places like Falmouth and Topsham and Ellsworth and Presque Isle. And from one end of the state to the other, all have these places that have been built on major roadways. And how do you bring some human scale, and how do you make it safe for people to walk around, and how do you have the kind of things there that are going to draw people and create a kind of place for people that where they want to live and they want to spend time.
All right. Well, we're talking about planning and being a planner and planning for your community. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Going through your website was so interesting, Sarah, but I wanted to ask you about a phrase I hadn't heard before that is talked about in your world, which is the whole concept of the new ruralism. What is the new ruralism?
So nationally, when we talk about planning, a lot of times it focuses on urban planning in big cities, Boston, New York, and part of Northern New England. We only have several cities that fit the definition of large urban areas. And so what we want to do is celebrate ruralism that isn't just a subset of a city. We don't just provide food and get some trickle-down effects from it, but celebrate the rural community as it is, as its own economy, and as a great sustaining place that those communities and the individuals who live within them work hard every day and have amazing systems in place to be self-supporting and to support each other within them. And so the idea behind New Ruralism is to create, we've started it here in Northern New England with some amazing people from the chapter, and are spreading the word nationally and building a national initiative to tell those stories about how people, about tools and tricks and ways that communities are able to lift themselves up in a rural fashion without necessarily relying on a lot of dollars from the local government or relying on an outside sources or private consultants to help them. And there's been some great examples here in Maine. Some are related to a sustainable fishing CSA and how, taking back that kind of part of the economy that way and making sure it's your own. There's been some other great examples in Maine, too, in different sections. And so what we're trying to do is celebrate those processes that allow small towns and communities to survive and thrive even more.
All right. What are some of the biggest issues facing planners? Off the bat, I'm guessing, and you can tell me if this is right, Mark, workforce, housing, high-speed internet, transportation.
Yes. I think all three of those. I think high-speed internet is an issue that is somewhat geographically different. Obviously, you get in some of the rural areas, almost any internet, decent service is a major issue. I think the other one is the big issue is really change. I mean, that's what thing is all about, is the question of how do you change? How does a community change? And, you know, there are a lot of people who, if you walked out on Congress Street in Portland and said, how do you want to change? They would say, we don't want to change. In fact, we liked it the way it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago. I think that issue of planning is really about thinking about how communities, how the state has to change, wants to change. And those are the real big issues. I mean, I was at a project site walk for a little residential subdivision, and all of the neighbors, if they had their druthers, would prefer to see that 30 acres stay just like it is. That's the real issue of how do you deal with change in a community and do it in a way that's positive.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking with municipal planners. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine, and Martin's Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine and New Hampshire, offering Generations Advantage, the only Medicare Advantage plan ranked 5 stars by Medicare in the state. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
Many campaign ads this fall have a unified theme.
We've got to fix healthcare.
John knows firsthand how important healthcare is for families.
Unlike him, I'll take on the big drug companies to reduce prices.
The candidates are playing to their voters.
We are seeing them take on healthcare more head on, in part because voters are so concerned about it.
Healthcare in the midterms this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. Maine Public News is holding 4 Your Vote 2018 debates, and you're invited to attend. This Sunday, the second congressional district and gubernatorial debates will be held in Bangor at Gracie Auditorium at Husson University. Attendance is free, but you must reserve your place in advance. Visit mainpublic.org and click on Your Vote 2018, where you'll also find more information, including the schedule.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the work of the Maine Association of Planners and professional planners generally. Joining me in the studio, Sarah Marchant is Director of Community Development for the City of Nashua, New Hampshire. She is also president of the Northern New England chapter of the American Planning Association in Maine this week for their big annual conference. Ben Smith is founder of North Star Planning, and Mark Eierman has been active in planning in Maine since 1975 and now runs the consulting firm Plan Me. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Trevor Jones, his Vice President of Sales, Marketing, and Customer Service at Otelco, a telecom company. Trevor, you do a lot of work with communities looking to improve broadband access. What are some common issues communities struggle with?
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and thanks for having me on the show today. You know, I think, you know, a lot's made of you know, broadband being critical infrastructure and utility similar to, you know, water or you know, or roads, and that's true. But I think it is different, and one of the many challenging ways in which it's different is it is a technology-based infrastructure, right? And so, you know, while, you know, town planners may be quite accustomed to working with, you know, water and you know, utilities, and whether we suppress utilities or put them in the air, you know, grappling with the technology side of things is new. And so that's something that they, you know, need to learn and need to adapt to. As they start, you know, engaging in the broadband planning process. Another thing I would say that's really critical is sort of getting an understanding of what's already there. It's never a good idea to spend money on something that may already exist. And you know, in the past, carriers were less forthright about sharing, you know, information about the infrastructure they had. You know, and I think, you know, we're seeing a lot more willingness on the part of you know, incumbent providers and current providers to share that information with planners so that, you know, they can focus on building a network in places where there's really a need. You know, the third thing I would say is, you know, sorting out the messages in the marketplace. Different providers, whether it's us or another provider altogether, we all have a particular way of doing things that we think is best. And, you know, a planner needs to be able to listen to those different alternatives and make an informed decision about what's the best solution for their community and their town. And it's not a cookie-cutter thing.
Well, Trevor, thanks so much for joining us. I understand you're speaking at the conference this week. Trevor Jones, Vice President of Sales, Marketing, and Customer Service at Otelco. I'm going to go to one quick little email to start our emails because this is fun. This is from Rick. Glad to see Mark is still in the planning business. You can't have enough good planners. P.S. Auburn is still arguing about the agriculture and resource protection zone.
Auburn has had one of the most interesting ways of dealing with residential development in the state of Maine, in that I'm guessing it's now 30 years ago, Auburn, unlike many communities that create rural districts, which are really low-density residential districts, created an agricultural zone in which the only residential development that is allowed is residential uses that involve agricultural natural resource uses. If you drive through Auburn today, in town is one of the most densely developed cities in the state, and the outskirts of Auburn is truly rural agricultural areas. And it's a thing that I think other communities could learn from.
Yeah, it is very, and I think in Southern Maine especially, this is one of the bigger issues, is how do you, you know, over time you think about a growing county or a growing community. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of these towns initiated zoning, and now you end up with orchards and fields and forests turning into subdivisions and houses. And people still think of these areas as rural. And I think this is part of the change that Mark was talking about earlier, is how do you recognize the change that's occurring, but also how do you shape or focus that change in a way that is good for the community? It's very interesting. All these zones are called farm zones, rural zones, but they really are low-density residential zones.
We'll go to Jane on Facebook. There is a successful community development and planning program active in Maine and across the USA called Community Heart and Soul. Mm-hmm. Biddeford, Gardner, and Damariscotta have completed this two-year program. Bucksport, Rockland, Bethel, Newry, Greenwood, and Woodstock are in the middle of it. It works to engage residents in finding what matters most to the residents, finding missing voices, and play the long game. It's bottom-up planning and community development. Do you think Maine's planners can and should adapt to listening more to community members, understanding that the community may think differently than planners do? I'm going to turn to you, Sarah, because you're nodding. You know about this.
Yes. Orton Family Foundation has kind of started something like this, but it is a pretty amazing grassroots, exactly as the caller suggested. It's a ground-up solution, and it is a wonderful solution. You get a lot of grassroots feedback, coordination, exactly what the community is looking for. It is incredibly time intensive, and it is incredibly important for people. The idea behind it is you motivate people to show up and to give their opinions and to make sure that everybody feels heard, and then to analyze that data together and plan for the future based on everybody showing up. And municipal planning, that is in many ways absolutely ideal, although we're all constrained by very significant budget constraints. And I think that the time involved in those efforts and why they're so successful is because they truly are grassroots. And it's not somebody sitting in city hall or town hall saying, come show up here. There's more volunteers. There's true commitment in that community to planning for the future and in understanding the change that has to occur, needs to incur, but also how they do that most effectively looking forward.
Yeah. We'll go to Maggie calling from York. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. It's good to speak with you all. This is very interesting to me. I'm a bit nervous. But my main concern is about bicycle paths. Now, here's the thing. I live in York, and in the mid-'80s, our town planners put a big moratorium on building permits. You had to wait. They gave out 10 a year. They thought this was a good thing because everybody was building. Now you can build anywhere. But what they didn't plan for in the 80s was still the influx of all these people coming in. We have two beautiful beaches. I live on the Nubble by the lighthouse. It takes me 40 minutes just to get out to Route 1 every single day in the summer. And I have families with little kids bicycling everywhere. Not only can't you get out, and they only have one route to get out, and you have to go through both beaches, but you're this obstacle path. My question is, I think bike paths are very, very important if you're in a community where people are vacationing all the time, and why didn't they see this in the 80s? I don't think they can do anything about it now. It's just a mess.
Maggie, thank you for your call. And before I have our panelists answer, I'm going to go to the next call because I believe Anne has a similar question. Anne is calling from Gray, a very different community than and York, but you're thinking about bike paths, aren't you, Anne?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so in 2012, a friend and I launched a bike ped committee because Gray has lots of traffic problems. We're not the sleepy little town that we were 30 years ago, you know, when I first moved here. And so I was really interested in having your guests talk about bike and pedestrian planning and sort of how that's been used in towns to improve walkability and improve and could kind of revitalize village areas and provide for recreation opportunities. And it does piggyback on this the previous caller's comments because I get those kinds of questions as well. People really worried about safety when on these narrow roads when. People, rural roads, when people drive really quickly,
yep.
How do you manage those bicyclists?
Anne, thank you. So first two callers from the public, Ben, want to talk about bike paths. Is this an issue you've worked on? And what advice do you have for communities who feel as though they need to increase safe bicycle access?
Yeah, I think it really is an issue in a lot of these more constrained communities where you don't have a lot of real estate, where you might not have a lot of road right-of-way to work with, places like York and Gray, but also communities like Yarmouth and Portland and even further afield. So there's a philosophy, complete streets philosophy, where, 20 years ago, people were building roads for cars. And complete streets is it's a movement or a philosophy that requires people to think more about people walking, people biking on the roadway. I think the other thing I would say is a lot of communities like Yarmouth and Brunswick, and I'm sure there are many others around the state, I believe Bethel, have done some wonderful things with separated bikeways. So you can get those facilities off street and you're not necessarily striping bike lanes on existing roads. You're building almost a separate corridor for bikes.
All right. An email. I hope your guests will be addressing how ways coastal communities will be able to tackle the problem of sea level rise, especially in small communities without large financial resources. One of you mentioned this earlier. Big issue for coastal communities. I believe you, Sarah, mentioned this.
Yeah. I think the sea level rise issue is one that communities are just beginning to understand. And actually, the Southern Maine Regional Planning Commission and now the state has developed a really good tool, a checklist kind of approach for communities to use to go through and really assess what the implications of sea level rise might be on their community, and then what actions they need to look at doing. But the first part about that process is really understanding what sea level rise could mean for the community, what public resources, what private resources are impacted. I do work with the town of Harpswell. One of the biggest issues is many of the roads that would be potentially impacted are private roads that have, let's say, less than stellar management. There's nobody really responsible for them, and that will be an issue as sea level rise occurs.
We'll go to Scott calling from Lisbon Falls. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm really interested in community development, and by that I mean as an extension of the way that we people have existed for tens of thousands of years, in kind of tribal community, as not to be tribal, but rather to be an extension of how we interact with one another. And to that end, interesting models are co-housing or agrihood, or in the highly built and designed community, places like Seaside in Florida, which were designed that way as well. And so I'm wondering if there's anything within this movement to develop the communities so that the community is more sustainable for the entire community. I mean, we all have this vision of our 1 acre plot in our McMansion, but yet we actually physically do better when we have closer proximity, such as cluster zoning.
Thanks, Scott. Sarah, I'm going to pass it to you.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of value in that, especially in this time of constrained municipal budgets. I mean, the more roads we have, the more long-term maintenance each community is committing to. I mean, every year those roads need to be plowed, iced, salted, sanded, and never mind all the regular pavement management, as Mark was mentioning earlier, with private roadways that are so difficult. I think in New England, as horse and buggy towns that were originally created with the planned downtown, but very rural areas around them, the idea of changing to something that is more forced or required in any way is something that just is not accepted, that the community themselves are not very interested in. There are some pockets, I think, of communities where people have decided to really invest in those kind of agri-housing, co-housing. I know in New Hampshire of one community. And so they have a small area of town that's really dedicated that way, and it works for the people who choose to be there. But I think asking or requiring everybody to live in a certain way like that is just not as reasonable here in New England as it might be in other places.
I think if you step back a little bit and you look at, like you said, a lot of these communities that grew up, you know, the distance of a stagecoach drive away from each other, and they have nice little downtowns, and everybody has the town that they can think of that they go to and they vacation to because it's beautiful and there's lots of things to walk to and to see. What had happened in the 60s and 70s starting then, but also continuing later, was the separation of uses. So basically we said, everyone's going to live over here and everyone's going to work over here. And you start to disaggregate these things. You know, people used to live in the same building they worked in sometimes. So I think getting closer to that is something that a lot of communities in Maine can draw from, even if you're not calling it the agri-hood or having a true co-housing setup.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break. Before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. Author Lois Lowry joins me as we mark the 25th anniversary of her book, The Giver. If you'd like to, you can email your comments or questions ahead of time to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post on our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine's Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. Ann Lamy Wellahan, a Maine family-owned shoe store since 1914, committed to keeping the entire family comfortable, healthy, warm, and dry.
On the next Speaking in Maine, we join Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport.
We've never fought wars before that were predominantly in cyberspace and outer space. That's the future that we're headed towards. It does not mean that there's a necessity for conflict.
James Miller is a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School whose work focuses on preventing war. He explores the unsettling U.S. relations with China and Russia. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
You've heard the tones before here on Maine Public Radio and perhaps also on Maine Public Television. Maine Public is the designated primary source for the entire state of Maine emergency alert system, which we transmit to all other stations for broadcast to all listeners and viewers all around the state. It's a valuable and important public service tool to help inform, alert, and warn citizens when situations warrant, and Maine Public's statewide infrastructure enables it to fulfill this vital task and public service.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the people behind how communities develop and respond to change. Planners. Joining me are three planners. Ben Smith, the founder of North Star Planning. Mark Eierman has been active in planning in Maine since 1975 and now runs the consulting firm Plan Me. And Sarah Marchant is president of the Northern New England chapter of the American Planning Association. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Ashley. How do you plan and create connectivity in rural areas that don't have a center? I'm a Raymond resident, and our town lacks a beating heart and center. At one point, 10 or so years ago, there was a moment to bring the town hall and library together in a single block, but it did not happen. Do you find many rural areas resist creating a town center? What would be the steps a community member could take to encourage their town council pursue a downtown plan? And I'm feeling, though, Mark, that Ashley's conversation is kind of related to what we were talking about before, just how do we build a community, how we think about community.
Yeah, I mean, they're really sort of, to me, sort of two parts to it. My wife and I live in a condominium community in Topsom, and the previous caller was talking about sort of activities. I live in a hyperactive community. We've had two block parties in the last month, and we will have a Halloween fire pit, costumes optional sort of activity. And part of that is proximity. Almost all of my neighbors walk by our unit on a daily basis. And that proximity, that knowledge, that comfort is part of what's there. To me, as a, I was always going to say a former parent, my 40-year-old son wouldn't appreciate that. But, you know, in schools have played that role. And a major issue in many communities in Maine is with declining school enrollments, the community elementary school is going away and kids are no longer being educated in the community. I think sort of the issue in many of the rural communities, and I think that was an issue in Raymond with elementary school students from the person who came in, it's really thinking about what's important in your community that can bring people to a common interest to do something. And that may not be in rural communities a physical place. It may be more of kinds of activities, sorts of programs, common interests that bring them together.
I would agree with that. I think that programming a space as an individual community member or as a small nonprofit organization, programming a space with those block parties, with those everybody get together for a s'mores campfire, programming a space regularly over time tends to build a sense of community around a space. So it doesn't have to be a physical buildings being next to each other so much as it does a place that is repeatedly thought of by the community as a place to gather and converse and celebrate each other and those connections. And I think that that's a good way to look at it.
We'll go to Beverly, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Beverly. Go ahead.
Hello. I live in a coastal city, Belfast, and Belfast has a climate change committee. I'm on that committee. We're working on adaptation strategies for our town, and we're also working on mitigation, which includes community and school kids' involvement in promoting as much sustainability as we can get. We would love to work towards 100% renewable energy, for example, and there's some communities doing that in the state. Pretty ambitious goal, but I think there are some people who are getting there. I'm wondering if your guests could comment on ways, exciting ways they've seen their communities get involved in working towards sustainability projects.
So my community, we just finished a Solarize Winterize campaign where the community put out an RFP, and actually several of the surrounding communities ended up joining in with us. And we had a solar installer and a home improvements winterization specialist that the city vetted. And between the two of them, they agreed to offer bulk pricing. And so we did a campaign over 4 or 5 months throughout the community, letting people know that they could have free evaluations of solar on their home to get those costs or winterization of their homes. And they got reduced pricing for being part of bulk purchasing. So that's one of the projects that we are just wrapping up. It did produce quite a few, a lot more solar panels of winterization, but we think we can learn for how we marketed the winterizing portion a little bit different.
I think that's really interesting to hear about local communities taking some of these things into account. It used to be if you had an issue like a wastewater issue, you'd go to the federal government and EPA would give you money. Or if you had a road problem, DOT, whether at the state or the federal level, would give you money to fix the problem, or they'd come do it for you. one of the big shifts that I think we're starting to get a sense of, and it's related to new ruralism, it's related to more local, is communities need to start thinking about ways to attack some of these problems on an individual community basis. And that's great that Belfast is going down that road.
Thank you, Beverly, for your call. We'll move on to Portland and Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. My question is the relationship that they perceive, the planners perceive, to their town councils, their policy-setting people that, they may be running ahead or behind, some of the aspects of the community. I know locally, I'm not going to name the community, but I think there's a slogan, keep this town rural, so to speak, and this is right in the Portland area. And so I'm just curious their feelings about the because I've heard a lot about getting the feedback, but really the town councils or the city councils, I mean they set the agendas. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, great. I'm going to turn to you, Mark, because you've done this the longest.
I would say the proverbial buck stops with whoever the legislative body in the community is, the council or the town meeting, and an essential part of the community planning process is that those legislators, whether it be 5 or 7 members of a council, or the larger group of voters that come to town meeting, are informed, brought into the process. I've worked in a couple of communities where any committee that's created in the community has a member of the council on it, many times as the chair. So that involvement of the political decision-making process is part of the planning process. And in reality, that's probably the way it has to work, unless you're going to do brute physical, organize on social media and try and overwhelm the political bodies.
I think that's the difference between that heart and soul approach, the ground up grassroots, versus the more top down bureaucratic town office organization.
Definitely. An email from Hal. Could you talk about universal design, providing access for all ages and abilities? How do you plan in cities, suburban or rural areas with universal design in mind?
When I think of universal design, I think of accessibility, and I think of making sure that the built environment is accessible to everyone regardless of their physical ability to maneuver. And, again, kind of bringing it back to that complete streets idea, if you are in a wheelchair or pushing a stroller or using a walker, you should be able to safely use a sidewalk or a crosswalk, as the same as anyone else.
I think we do really well with new construction and new building. I think that in general, that we take that into consideration, and communities are very good at doing the new. I think where we struggle and where we all look for more guidance and more help is with the infrastructure that's been around since the dawn of time, right? And how do we safely and effectively convert that to be helpful and useful to universal design, whether it be the wheelchair or the blind or anybody who's trying to use that system.
Mandy on Facebook says, if there is anyone interested in delving into these issues and many more that concern building strong Maine cities and towns, please check out the Build Maine Conference, which happens in June 5th and 6th, 2019. Mandy will be happy to know that our guests here are nodding at her suggestions. An email from Michelle. I feel like a lot of planning does not take into account what's already working in other countries when it comes to things like mass transit and bike transit, for example. We seem to be reinventing the wheel. Could they talk about something they've seen somewhere else and have tried to apply here?
I think we just recently started Bike Share, which I think you in Portland have for quite a while. And that's something that we've adopted from the Netherlands, I believe. And I will just say, in New England, we have wonderful Yankees, and one of the things I hear all the time is I don't want to hear what they're doing. I want to talk about what we're doing. So I think that sometimes it's very hard for people. The people are interested in those ideas, but they necessarily don't believe that they could be implemented here. And so sometimes change is hard. Again, back to that change management process. But bike share is something that I think is spreading all over New England, and it is a great example of adaptive technology.
Jennifer, and I think really the pattern of development, the density of activity, is a key factor in what you can learn from, in that many of the European models are significantly more dense. And if you have a tram stop, 1,000 people live within a 2-block area of it. Those sorts of issues, the issue of how spread out our population is, makes many of the transportation issues, other than the automobile, a very difficult solution. You know, there's a joke among some of the transportation people about why is the guy with the briefcase and the tie riding the bus? Was it DUI or is his car getting repaired? You know, the people who have a choice very often opt for the automobile simply because of the convenience with the pattern of development we have in the three northern New England states.
An email from Mark. Interesting comment about the new ruralism. Is there any value for new urbanism in a low population state like Maine, or have traditional New England towns already solved it?
You know, I think this is an area that smaller Maine communities and New England communities can borrow some of the best ideas from the bigger cities and incorporate what makes sense. I don't know if I would call it new urbanism if you're talking about Dover Foxcroft or Caribou, but I think there's certainly some things you can learn. And like Mark was saying, you know, proximity of uses, getting more people into downtowns, the places that you want to have gravity, the places that you want people to go to. So I guess that's what I'd say about that.
I would agree with Ben, but I think new urbanism is based on our New England model. I know going to new urbanism conferences, yeah. You know, they literally have plans of our communities from the 1800s with the stagecoach model. And so That's what they're trying to replicate in other parts of the country. So I think we do that piece well. It's how do we maintain that piece and how do we keep it going?
All right. Well, I'm going to end with an email from Ken. I just want to thank all the various people who serve on the many planning boards, committees, etc. Their patience must be incredible because, as one of my daughters is fond of saying, everyone wants progress, no one wants change. My hat is off to you all. So, Ken, thank you for that nice email. And thank you for our guest today, Sarah Marchant, Director of the Community Development for the City of Nashua, New Hampshire, also President of the Northern New England Chapter of the American Planning Association. Ben Smith, founder of Northside Planning. Mark Eierman, a semi-retired planner who was active in planning in Maine since 1975 and now runs the consulting firm Plan Me. John Keimel ran the board. The show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling.